NationalRescueConsultants.com is your source for all education in the USAR world, man versus machine, and advanced survival tactics. Go check out NationalRescueConsultants.com today, a proud sponsor of the Can Man Radio Show.
Get off your ass, canners, and get ready for some extreme tabletop exercises. It's time for the Can Man Radio Show. And now, your fearless leader, the senior canner himself, Jason Liska.
It's a windy, rainy, and kind of dreary Monday as we kick off a new season and a new episode of the Can Man Radio Show. I want to welcome you all back. We've got a very special guest in here today that we're going to introduce here in just a moment, a veteran firefighter, someone who's walked the walk and talked the talk in a lot of ways, someone who's been through, I would call life-changing experiences in more than one way, including a recent transplant last September. And he had the opportunity to recently share his story on a couple of different podcasts. He was on the NRC podcast, National Rescue Consultants podcast, with Herbie and those boys and Rob. And, that guy with the mustache occasionally wears it. What's his name, Maddie? What's that guy's name? Greg? Yeah, I don't mention it unless he has a mustache. I don't mention his name. But today we have Maddie Johnson in with us. And, Maddie, it is just a few days before something very special, if you know what I'm talking about. What is that? What is that? Could that be music indicating that we've got St. Patrick's Day coming up? Shenanigans?
Shenanigans.
What was that place there, Farva, with all the tchotchkes on the wall?
Shenanigans.
Oh, you said it. All right. Yes, it is just a few days before the St. Patrick's Day and the shenanigans to follow. So anyway, back to where we were. Maddie, I want to welcome you to the show, and I want to thank you for coming in today and giving us your time to tell your story. And we're going to have that opportunity now. So let's go ahead and start off with the basics. All right. So tell me a little bit about yourself, a little bit of your background. I know you came in this field in like 2007, so not too long ago. You've got a young career and plenty more years ahead of you, but let's go with that.
Let's see. I was born in Miami, Florida.
Yeah.
My father is a Vietnam vet and ex-Miami or Metro-Dade police officer.
Right on.
In Miami. Got a wonderful mom. I am the only child. Again, grew up in sunny South Florida. Went to I guess a whole bunch of high schools and middle schools in my day.
Did you really?
I did.
Were you
a
troubled child back then?
I feel like I just wanted to experience as much as the public school education as well as private school education I had to offer.
You're very brazen. You're bold and brave at the same time. I like that. Brazen,
yes,
bold and brave.
Yes. And after that, first fire department job was down in the Keys.
Yeah.
And worked down there for almost 9 years.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Awesome time. It's a very humbling working for a small department with not a lot of manpower.
Yeah, you're so surrounded by water and far away from everything.
Yeah, but the problem with that salt water is once it gets in the pump, man, it's no good.
Not the same. Not the same.
Yeah, drafting with salt water is no good.
Yeah.
And after that, moved up, and now I'm in Broward County at a very busy department, and it's amazing. People are great, and it's a blessing.
I was going to say, I don't think there are very many departments down there that are slow, to be honest. I have a lot of students who come from down in South Florida at the fire college and as well teaching through Kaiser. And I'll tell you this, some of them are just getting into this field. Some of them are former military and they're like, well, I want to go work for Miami-Dade. I want to go work for this department. I'm like, you can do that. Just understand what you're walking into. If you've never experienced this job before, that Miami-Dade is a hell of a first experience for a department, and very difficult
time
to get into.
100%. What was funny is I did this backwards. I worked for a very nice, slower department.
Right.
Good calls every once in a while.
Right.
then went to a really, really busy department, lots of calls, lots of energy. So I kind of did it backwards. I should have done the really busy one when I was younger and then gone back down to the Keys and retired down there.
So, you know, growing up in South Florida, I came on when I was like 14. I was a cadet with Palm Beach County. I say cadet now because that's the term they're using versus explorer. I guess that doesn't exist much anymore. And then I volunteered and dispatched down there. We moved up here. I guess I kind of, I don't know if I did it backwards or if I jumped the gun and went to the slower part of Florida early enough in my life. Maybe it was the right or the wrong, who knows, but I did 8 years in a small agency in North Central Florida and loved it there. And then I went to Lake and I've been there ever since, where I sit now is a Lou. And I'll tell you, the night and day difference, you know, it's amazing how many people actually retreat from South Florida to come north, whether it's for the experience or a change of pace or, you know, how hard it is to get hired down there. I mean, a lot of people come up here for experience to get a job and they get a couple of years on, they go on and move back home. But some people stay, and there's something to be said for staying up here because we're not as busy. We're not as metropolitan. You know, I mean, we have my department, we're just under 30 stations, and the manpower has increased significantly since I've started. But it's a different way of life, even though we do the same job. It's just a different pace in a sense. And I look at my friends who are still down there compared to my career here, and it's like, I don't have it so bad. You know, an engine company officer is not a bad place to be, you know.
You definitely eat better on a slower department. Definitely eat better.
And I wouldn't say we're slow. I just say that it's a different change of pace. You know, so we're not running the 100,000, you know, 200,000 call range like South Florida. We're probably, if you count all the VMS, we're probably 30 to 50, depending on how it goes. EMS typically runs a lot more calls, right? That's just the way of the business. But we're not slow.
100%. Pays the bills.
Different.
EMS pays the bills.
Yeah. And it's different in the mindset. You see people from South Florida and people from North Florida. It's like you see the way they carry themselves, their swagger and their personalities. It is a real difference between South Florida and North Florida.
I love it, man. The 305 mentality, the South Florida, it's, you know, a guy from Miami when he walks inside the room. And I dig that. I like that a lot.
Oh man, I'll tell you, and one day when you say, hey, I want to change of pace, you're going to come up here and you're going to realize this is where I needed to be all along. The tranquility of it.
I did that for a little bit. I was living up north, a little bit, in Palm Beach, and I hated it when I got up there, man. You know, I was missing the city life, and it maybe took 2.5-3 weeks and I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And, but again, I'm back down in Miami now and loving every second of it.
Oh, you can't not love Miami. The energy, the beauty of the architecture and the coffee. You can't go wrong with any of the
cuisine.
The cuisine.
The Cuban coffee. Oh. What's even funnier is going up into North Florida and these other states with the training cadre and stuff and introducing people to Cuban coffee for the first time. It's amazing.
Looking at their faces, the moment it crosses their lips and they feel that almost sense of urgency to keep going and that rush they get from the moment it crosses their lips into their belly. It's like, ooh, oh yeah. I there she is right there. I know that look.
I had a division chief. He was Italian.
Yeah.
And he's a deputy now. And he used to say, it's not Cuban coffee. It's Italian coffee with sugar in it.
Well, depending on if you want to break it down that way, that may be the case. Yeah. But I do miss this. You know, working at the fire college before the pandemic, we used to get a lot of people from South Florida, Marathon, the Keys, Miami, Broward. And usually one in each group would bring all of the equipment they needed to make coffee. They'd bring this pot, this burner, they'd bring all of it, and they'd make coffee for all the classrooms first thing in the morning. It became almost a standing tradition. And then,
you know,
COVID hit.
What's funny is that mustache guy you were talking about earlier, Greg Rogers, that's his deal. He's a Cuban coffee man.
See, we can only mention his name if he brings the mustache into the game. I'm sorry. Greg Rogers is a beautiful man and a good friend, but the mustache is what makes Greg. He's a short guy otherwise. He's just a short guy without it, you know?
He's an amazing man.
He is a beautiful man. And I did not know about his Cuban coffee game. I might have to put him on task that one.
That's what he does, man. He shores and makes Cuban coffee. Guy's an animal.
He's a shoring and coffee animal.
100%.
Those are two good traits to have. Two good traits to have. I like that.
Good boss.
So let's talk about how we came to this point. You know, I know we've crossed paths a few times between OFC and a few other places. And then recently we met up and had the chance to talk on the phone at the request of Herbie, because you had a very great episode with Herbie and the boys. And then you had an opportunity to sit with Corley Moore and, you know, do the scrap with him and a few others at OFC. And one of the things Herbie and I always have aligned with is the importance of getting a good message out. And the Train to Live podcast does that certainly. And I know Corley, with every episode he does of his scrap, it's got a point, a purpose, and it helps inspire people to do better with their set, with their lives, their position. Opportunities are always presented in these conversations to grow. And what I do want to reflect on, though, before we get to that, is roughly 2020 when I was up in Georgia at a conference, and we found out that you were pretty sick and in the hospital, and they weren't anticipating you living even at that point. Let's talk about just a little bit before that and maybe what led you to that point and where we're at today. And we're going to kind of just dabble in different areas as we go through that. Okay.
Okay. I guess first and foremost, you just got to, I guess we could start with my drinking career.
Okay.
Again, it was always around. Growing up for me, drinking was something that went with every event, whether we were, and it, I guess it's the same in terms of the fire service.
Right.
Whether there was a birthday, whether there was a wedding, whether there was a divorce party, it didn't matter. Like, booze is very prevalent, backyard barbecues, watching sports games, everything. And, again, family being Irish, it was, even more so. So we had extra holidays. Mm-hmm. Everything was a party, which was a lot of fun when I was younger. I guess what switched for me as far as my drinking career was me not accepting the fact that I was facing some difficulties as far as, mental health is concerned.
Okay.
And I guess, I was afraid to say the word depressed, or I thought I was special in the sense that I, even though I clinically, if I were to WebMD what depression was, I hit every single one of them.
Right.
But I would find one little one on WebMD that I didn't have. And I was like, oh no, this can't be me.
I get you.
Yeah. And, I guess that's when it switched, when drinking and that fellowship and that camaraderie that I felt when I was doing it with the boys and, you know, my friends and my family reminded me of something that was very, very happy for me. Okay. It was like always a good time. And then when I started dealing with depression and friends passing away and, you know, I guess not getting over it health or in a healthy way, mm-hmm. I wanted those happy times so much. And, you know, alcohol being the catalyst to making the times better just turned into something that I was kind of treating my depression with.
So, man, you just hit on like 100 million different things here that we talk about on a daily basis, you know, facing problems, drinking them away, acknowledging history, culture, whatever you want to throw into this. You know, I mean, there's a million different aspects we could expand on. But how about we do this? The culture around you at the time, how about that? The culture around you at the time in your early days of this profession had to have an impact on you as well. So the people you hung out with, obviously, their mindsets, their mentalities, your ability to relate to them. And in some ways, did you feel like maybe you were trying to keep up with the Joneses in that sense? Or did you feel like maybe this was just the path that was meant to be because you saw everybody else doing it? And it was just easier to do that than it was to face your own problems.
I mean, in the beginning of the fire service career, I was young enough, and I think that I started off in my drinking career was very, I was in the major leagues when I joined the fire service, and that was when I was 23 years old.
Okay.
So it wasn't really keeping up at that point. If anything, the fire service tradition I used as almost an excuse to do more drinking than I probably should.
Okay.
I had such a good time in the beginning of like the first, like, I don't know, like 10 years of my career, mm-hmm. With all of that, whether it be a promotion, whether it be a retirement, whether it be going to New York for 9/11, they were amazing times that were just better because we were all drinking, because we were doing toast. And not to mention when I joined the Fools and then I ended up writing that toast, then it became like an entire thing. My life was completely involved with Guinness, Jameson, drinking, mm-hmm. Putting a leather fire helmet on. It just went together.
Right.
But I never felt pressured by anybody to drink more than I wanted to. If anything, I was the guy that was like, no, you guys need to take another shot.
Right.
You know, if that makes any sense.
You were the life of the party, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, would you say that's fair to say?
I think so. Yes. Only because I was trying. And sometimes it was now looking back of it, I was obnoxious.
Okay.
Because I was trying to go out of my way to do that. It wasn't natural.
Okay.
And again, it was, I hate to say that, but the majority of it was just a lot of fluff. It was the booze talking. Even then, when I was dealing with depression and drinking and trying to present being happy, I was just that persona, that Matty Johnson was up on giving a toast and doing all that shit, was just me trying to like, I was acting. It was like, I was trying to mirror a person that I wish that I really was feeling internally. And I definitely wasn't.
So what were you trying to block? What were you trying to fight from coming out?
Fucking crying for one. Okay. Every celebration in the fire service, for me at least, started turning into, and even in the young portion of my career with Bill Manning dying, it was like every single one of them, it was like there was one less person that was there hanging out, partying, who we were teaching with, who we were doing things with. And right. And not to mention, at the same time, my outside life without the fire service, I had friends that were overdosing. I had friends that were committing suicide. That had absolutely nothing to do with work, but it all melts together. Yeah. And it was hard. I had a lot of acute death early on in my life, and it just carried on. And it got to the point where I almost wanted to stop having friends because I was just tired of burying them.
Okay.
Is what it turned into.
Okay.
And I think that had a lot to do with that. I was friends with everybody, and I made it a point to try to be friends with everybody. And, yeah, it's just when you do that and you make your circle so big, you're bound to lose people.
So getting back to the emotional side of it, though, you're trying to prevent yourself from crying, from releasing that anger, that mm-hmm. anxiety, that aggression. And, you know, I'm not a therapist, not a counselor, but I'm hearing your words. And what I'm trying to expand on with you is the drinking was more of a shield or yes. a barrier. Okay. Which is very relatable. Okay. We often use our dark experiences and relate to them in ways. We talked about it earlier. It's no secret amongst our peers how we relate, through dark humor and through other aspects. But you were taking this on a personal level, including those who impacted you in your career that you lost around you and how your circle was shrinking in some ways, almost like you were seeing the ghosts of them there while you were out engaged in your circle. But you were trying to mask that pain in a different way by using alcohol to do that instead of looking for other ways to get help. Is that what I'm interpreting here? Is that what I'm gathering?
150%. It's a lot easier to take a drink than to pick up the phone and, you know, call someone and tell them that you're hurting. It was just you hit the nail on the head. It was an excuse. It was that shield that if I was drinking and I was acting like I was happy because I was outlandish, then we don't need to really look at what's going on internally.
Right. Look over here, but don't look over here. In other words,
exactly. It was the sleight of hand. 100%.
People can say Matty Johnson, the party animal. We love being around him. He's charismatic. He's beautiful. But deep inside, you're fucking hurting. You're dying inside, literally dying inside, yeah. Which is going to lead up to, you know, what we'll talk about here in a moment. So when did you start noticing the subtle cues? I mean, at some point you had to stop worrying about fucking hangovers. You had to stop worrying about things that impacted you outside of the drinking, because if you're a major leaguer, you don't let that shit bother you. So you're a functioning alcoholic at this point in your career. How was that starting to, well, what were some of the subtle signs that were cueing into this was a bigger problem?
When I would say one of the biggest ones is when you sit there and you start drinking and you're gauging when you can have your last drink so that you can pass the breathalyzer if you had to go piss day.
Yeah.
That was a big one. I honestly think the biggest one was when the drinking alone started. Once the drinking alone started, there was no holds bar as far as what I was capable of or how much I was capable of drinking.
Right.
Because you didn't need an excuse. It wasn't like, I'm going to go drink because I'm going, out to Fridays, or, I'm going to go do this because it's so-and-so's birthday. When you start drinking at home by yourself, without the social aspect to mm-hmm. it, it's downhill.
Yeah. Well, there's no one to bounce off of, no one to stop you, no one to interfere in what you're doing.
No. And it's not even like it's cathartic there. It's not like you're having a couple drinks and you're sitting there and you're getting through like a deep emotional conversation with one of your buddies.
Right.
And there's going to be like some reprieve or like a good story or a good ending to it. You're by yourself with me, with my demons and my dead friends that were in my head.
Right.
And it's horrible, but that's your comfort zone. So you retreat back to that. And then you start retreating to feeling comfortable. And hey, if I'm by myself and I'm inside this room and the lights are off, then I'm going to bring my buddy Jack Daniels with me. I'm going to have my buddy Jameson come over
right.
and we're going to hang out together. And yeah, that's the sad reality. And I don't think I enjoyed the last maybe 4 to 5 years of me drinking. It was more of just like a maintenance.
Okay. So it was a requirement almost. It was like, if I'm at this level, not this level, then I got to bump it up back to the level I need to be at.
Oh yeah. And it got to the point where I was like actively withdrawing while I was on shifts. Like it was bad, bad, really? Bad, bad.
Well, that's got to lead towards 2020 then, you know, we're talking mm-hmm. January, February, 2020. A lot of us were in Georgia. I was with Herb. I was with Rob. I don't think Greg made that trip. I was with Jake Johnson. I was with Sean Duffy. I was with a bunch of people and your name came up and that you were in the hospital at that point. So this was just 3 years ago, you know, mm-hmm. Let's walk through that.
So I was really getting bad right around then. My relationships were shot with my family, with the woman that I was with at the time. They were just, I was a shell of who I used to be at that time.
Okay.
I was drunk all the time. I was useless to say the least. So the depression had really kicked up at this point and everyone at this, there was no hiding it anymore. And people were starting to get vocal about it. I ended up, there was an intervention that happened where, a captain of mine and a chief, a battalion, mm-hmm. two of my closest friends ended up coming to the house and being like, "Hey, listen, we need you to go." It was an intervention and mm-hmm. I lost my mind. Mm-hmm. It didn't go the way they planned. And I was like, "Listen, I'll go, but I'm going to wait till after Christmas."
Yeah.
And, one thing that I will say about this is when you're going to treatment for another reason, and mine was to appease people that thought I needed to go,
right.
It is not going to work.
No.
If you're not going there for yourself, it is pointless to go.
Well, it makes you wonder. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please. I apologize.
No. So what ended up happening was I waited till the end of the month and I went to the facility and I did a month stint at the firefighter sleepaway camp, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And, after getting out of there, I was like, "Oh, I'm cured. You know what? I'm sober. I've been clean for a month. Everything's going to go back together. Everything's going to go back to normal. My life's going to get fixed. My relationship's going to get fixed. Everything's perfect." Mm-hmm. That is not what fucking happens at all. Life moves on. People move on. Everything keeps moving while you're in this bubble that is the rehabilitation center. I came back and what I learned the hard way is that sober does not mean happy. That's like, it doesn't. And I did what everyone does, or the majority, a lot of people do, that went to rehab for the wrong reason. I relapsed, and I relapsed in a very, very bad way. I went to Flanagan's and drank a bottle of Jameson, had to Uber home, and then I kept drinking. Mm-hmm. In 2020, my aunt was in hospice, and my father was going to visit her. So I left the firehouse, and we flew up to New Jersey. While I was up there on the day we were supposed to leave, I ended up, my dad told me I didn't look good and I ended up vomiting, laying in the bed and it was all blood. Mm-hmm. Rescue was called. I was transported to the hospital. I passed out in the back of the rescue, whole bunch of blood transfusions. I got flown to another hospital. They did a emergency procedure called a TIPS procedure, mm-hmm. which deals with portal hypertension, and they just add a shunt and it's like a Band-Aid. It's not permanent. It's not going to fix you for everything. It's so that you can get on a transplant list. And this is right around the time that you guys heard about this. I had that done. And then that's why the GoFundMe started, because they had to get me back to Miami.
Right.
And, or to Fort Lauderdale, excuse me. And I was flown back to Fort Lauderdale. And we were talking about this on, March 17th, went ahead and, decided to have a seizure and, you know, the extubation happened. And that was my sober date. So March 17th is actually an amazing day for me. Besides the fact it's Patty's and get to hang out with all my buddies, but that's make 2 years sober for me. So,
man. All right. I want to go back into rehab real quick because you hit on some key points and something I never thought about. Appeasing mm-hmm. your peers, your friends, your family. Okay. If you want me to go, I'll go mentality. But deep down inside, you're saying, it won't be so bad. I can do this. I can handle this. But what they don't know is you're not engaged in the mindset to follow through on what this whole purpose is. So let's talk about rehab. Let's talk about the time you spent there. What were the mechanisms they tried to instill upon you to help you with this recovery process, to help get you back on track? Because there has to be a purpose to rehab, not just drying out. And you knew deep down inside, subconsciously, this was not it. This was just you getting them off your back. But what is the purpose once you're through those doors? What are they trying to accomplish with you to help you grow? And what could you have learned had you really been considerate of it then, you know, and maybe not drink after?
Well, one thing I will say about the first time that I went to rehab is I treated it like, it's going to be funny, but I treated it like Target Solutions.
Okay. Point and click. Yeah.
It might have been beneficial.
Yeah.
If I would have taken it as that.
Okay.
But it wasn't. I was given a task that I knew I had to complete in order to appease other people. And that is the sole reason that I went to get better.
Okay.
I did not acknowledge the fact that I had an issue with drinking. I didn't acknowledge the fact that I had an issue with depression.
Yeah.
It was, I went through that entire month and I sat there and I lied to a therapist so that I could get out of this program and I could get on with my life because I thought I didn't need any help.
Do you think the therapist picked up on that?
150%.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can't, these people are trained, and especially the program that I was in, was through FHE Health and it was called Shatterproof. Mm-hmm. And, if you know someone who is a first responder or is issues, whether it's military, fire, anything like that, it is an amazing, amazing program. Rick George is one of the clinicians there, mm-hmm. from Palm Beach County. And well, we'll get into how it worked the second time that I went because I had a different mindset.
Okay.
But it was an amazing, amazing experience when I went there for the right reasons.
So, okay. When did they call you out then? When did they know you were bullshitting?
Right off the get, because you have a lot of people that are in there that actually are there, like the second time that I went, that are there to get help and do these things. And now when I went back and I saw it and I realized what I was doing the entire time, you sit there and you click up in a group and then you sit there and you just talk shit about the people that are trying to get help.
Right.
Because you're above it. Because you don't need to fucking be here. Or, I'm just doing this because I got screwed up at work and there was a court case, and you kind of try to fit in with those people.
Okay.
And, when you start answering questions, the people that are overseeing everything, the clinicians are 150% aware that you're not in it for the real reasons,
but they still invest in you.
They do, and they try to break you every single time, but there's only so much your insurance and your pocket will allot for you to go through these trainings,
right?
Or these sessions.
Right.
And so after a month, they got to cut you loose, especially if you don't want to be there. And the entire time I was there the first time, all I was trying to do was get out.
Okay.
The techniques were 100% beneficial the second time I went in with the right mindset.
All right.
They go into detail about, you growing up and specific ways to cope. EAP and all that stuff has that. I mean, when you get into like a program like this, it's because you didn't do what you were supposed to beforehand.
Okay.
And you're trying to make up for it.
Right.
But the counselors are amazing. They add a lot of physical exercise as well as mind work, a lot of meditation, a lot of breathing exercises. And to see the changes in forget so much the fire service, but actually the veterans that come into these programs and have really, really gone through some really traumatic experiences with, loss of life or brothers that were on the team with them, or, even civilian casualties, to see them come out stronger is amazing and a testament to the program. And it works just as well with police and the fire side as well.
So what you're talking about are coping skills, coping mechanisms.
100%. Coping and accepting the fact that, you are suffering from PTSD or you are suffering from depression, and really just getting yourself to admit, because if you lie to yourself, you'll lie to everybody else. Uh-huh. I realized that real early on. But once I took full responsibility of the fact that, fuck, man, I have a problem, I need to fix it. Everything got progressively better in my treatment.
You hit on the fact that one of the things they like to do is examine your childhood, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to know. And when you put coping mechanisms next to childhood or adolescence, I'm thinking, were these lessons missed? Okay, by your parents? Mm-hmm. Were these not societal lessons imprinted upon you, as you were growing? What did you find you were lacking that really, really impacted you most and helped you better understand how and why you needed to recover? And that might segue into the second round of rehab.
My childhood was amazing. And which is, I guess, a good way to look at the fact that you don't need to come from a shitty situation to develop problems like
right.
this.
Okay.
My relationship with my parents were amazing. Again, my dad, Vietnam era police officer, very stoic, handshakes. We're not going to worry about you crying on the floor if you fell over and you cut your knee.
Right.
You need to get up. This isn't serious. I had a very, very loving family. So if anything, my issue kind of might have stemmed from the fact that I didn't want to disappoint anybody for not being like that. I guess like that man that just like brushes everything off. Nothing fucks with me. Nothing bothers me. Not showing emotion. So it took me a long time because it's almost like you feel like you're disappointing, like maybe your parents or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like you're not man enough to like hold the family name kind of thing. And, so that was something that I had to come over that okay. like, this isn't define me as a person because I'm dealing with depression, or this doesn't make me, I guess like any less manly from me sitting here and actually talking about my feelings. I got a lot out of the open forum and listening to other people share similar experience, because like I have a guy who's maybe 20 years in the military, who's fought in the war, who's done this stuff, who's sitting there and explaining something very, very similar to the emotions. And this guy's tough as fuck.
Right.
And I'm looking at him like, there's no way he's going to say that. Now he's saying it. And it really opened my eyes to like, man, you know, I'm not really being judged right now. Mm-hmm. I can make this work for me. And once that hit and I accepted the fact that I did have an issue and these problems, it made all the difference in the world as far as me coming around.
You hit
on
something.
And that was during myself.
Yes. And you hit on something real quick, not to backtrack, but your dad, and we talked about this the other day, actually. Mm-hmm. He had a sense of discovery in that time frame too, and came to fruition on a few different points in his life where he failed in a sense, not in a bad way, but just wasn't able to cope in a way that, you know, you are now. And coming from his mm-hmm. generation, and we talked about this, the hardened mentality of the men who came from that as fathers, you know, who went to Vietnam, who came back, who literally grew up with fathers who were in Korea or World War II. And, you know, they're part of that baby boomer generation in a sense. And there was no time for nonsense, no time for feelings in most cases. And I'm giving cliff notes or just thoughts here, but the generation that preceded us two generations, three generations ago, even, coping, what was that? You dealt with it. You moved forward, you pushed on. And even that trickled down into our lives in a way. And so in a sense, you felt like maybe you couldn't show emotion because you had to demonstrate that level of stoic behavior, that mentality of not giving into your feelings and just pushing forward and letting things go the way they're supposed to go in your mind.
Yeah, it was the, I guess the coping meant shut up and pour me another drink kind of mentality, which basically what it was. And that's exactly what I did. It's a lot easier to sit there and have a, you know, like a mouthful of Jameson as opposed to sit there and tell someone your feelings.
Right.
And yeah, again, that ego is a killer. It's a silent killer. And, because you're afraid of being judged, you're afraid of being judged by your peers. You're afraid of everything. Your significant other, you don't want to seem like less of a man or because you can't handle your shit. It's a wicked road, but it's 150% fixable if you recognize the signs and you start treatment early.
Okay.
And you don't have to end up like I did.
All right. Let's go into round two.
So, I have the issue in New Jersey where everything happens. I get flown home and that was horrible. It was horrible for my parents. They had to fly up. My mom had to come relieve my dad so he can get back home.
Right.
I come back, I wake up in the hospital, and it was very, very emotional. Like, I woke up and I realized I almost died. I could see the look on my parents' face. I had people coming in to visit me from the department. And it was heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. About when I started being able to like have conversation, I remember I had a doctor come in, my parents weren't in the room, and he told me, he's like, listen, you know, the TIPS procedure went well. You're going to start feeling better. We're going to get you into a rehab. You're going to start learning how to, I mean, at this time I couldn't use my hands. I didn't know how to walk. I couldn't shit. I couldn't do anything. I had tubes all over.
How old were you?
This time, let's see, it was, let's see, 21. It was 2021. This is March of 2021.
You're right. 2021. My apologies. 2021. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So March of 2021, that was 2 years ago. So I was 36.
Okay. Okay.
When he sat down and he looked at me and he was like, listen, everything's going to get better. He's like, but you're going to have to get a liver transplant or you're going to die. We have to get you on a list. We have to do all these things. Yeah. So I had failed miserably at trying to get sober before. Mm-hmm. So I had a really big realization while I was in the hospital. I was like, you know, I'm grateful to be alive. You know, I'm humbled by this entire experience. It knocked me down to nothing. I go, there's no way that I can possibly stay sober. So I don't want to get on a list.
Okay.
I got a phone call from one of our senior drivers at work. And he was like, listen, you're meant for more than this. You need to turn your life around. Listen, you're charismatic, you know, all this shit. And he was like, your mother, your parents. And I ended up fucking crying. It was like one of the longest crying experience I had. Mm-hmm. There was this beautiful nurse in there that sat there and talked me through this thing. It was an amazing experience.
Right.
And I came out of it with this new mindset. But what ended up happening was I was like, all right, well, I need to continue working on my mind. So one of my captains and good friends, Joe Fox, was at the hospital. I was like, hey, man, I really need to go back to rehabilitation. But, mm-hmm. And he was like, all right, no problem. So once I got healthy enough to get out of the hospital, I went to a occupational therapy place first, learned how to walk, talk, do all those things. And that was a very interesting experience because I was trying to get out of there real quick because I was motivated for the first time in a very, very long time.
Did it help?
And
that motivation, did it help?
Well, so I was, this is funny. I'm in North Broward Hospital.
Yeah.
And when you're there and had what I just had and being intubated for weeks, you lose everything. The atrophy happens. You forget how to do every basic thing in your entire life. You can't eat, you can't pick things up, right. You can't ball up a piece of paper, you can't go to the bathroom. So that's what they're bringing you to the facility to teach you how to do everything. Well, it moves very, very, very slow. And the majority of these patients that go into these places, if it's not like from a really bad head trauma, the majority of them are elderly. So they move, everyone on the staff is used to elderly patients. So they're not used to a young guy who wants to get out and go
right.
And run and do things.
Right.
So about the first day I was like, I need to learn how to walk again, and trying to get up and do these things were damn near impossible. Well, I ended up figuring out that if I could pull myself kind of around the bed, and I ended up disengaging the alarm on it for mm-hmm. the weight distribution. So once I did that, I was able to slide myself out of the bed and crawl over to the door, and I would lock the door at like maybe 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So for 3 days I did this, and I just sat there and kept pulling myself up and trying to walk, pulling myself up and trying mm-hmm. to walk. Mm-hmm. Third day I ended up getting it.
Okay.
And I was able to take a couple steps, and then it just got better and better and better. But I'd have to hide and jump back into bed. They'd come and I'd be like, oh, I don't know why the door's locked. it was a process. Well, anyway,
my mom
was coming to visit, and I went into the bathroom and I wanted to walk out and show that I could walk. And she's sitting in the room. She's like, hey, do you need help? And I was like, no, no, no. And I opened the door and I walked out of the room. My mom's like, oh my God. Right.
Yeah.
Crying the entire thing.
Yeah.
What I didn't realize is that the entire clan of doctors were standing right at the doorway and saw me walk out. And they were like, you can walk?
What the
and
fuck?
I was like, they were like, cause I wasn't allowed out of the bed without a walker, and I had to be with somebody. And then I take a few steps. They put me back in bed, and I was like, oh yeah, you know, I just got up. And they were astounded.
Right.
I had one more day left, and boom, you know, I was out of the hospital,
right.
Hit the ground running. I went to outpatient therapy for a little while. And then right after that, I went back into the rehab facility with the right mindset this time. I was excited to get back there. I was excited to not have my phone for a week. And I wanted to get as much out of it as I could. And I wanted to get the fuck out of there as soon as possible.
Right.
Because the doctor told me I've only got a year to live, a year and a half to live.
Without the liver transplant.
So I'm on it without the liver transplant, but I'm not getting it because I can't stay sober. So I'm on a fucking time schedule. I got to go, man. I'm moving. It's that fourth quarter mentality. Mm-hmm. And so I was in treatment. And it was, everything was making sense.
Okay.
I was open. I was the one that was raising my hand all the time. It was awesome. Rick George was there.
Yeah.
And I could see it in his face that he was starting to see me come around. I got out, graduated from the sleepaway camp for my second go around. And, I got out and I was able to return to, light duty at work.
Okay.
I couldn't get cleared to go back to work from my doctors I went to like 18 of them.
Wow.
And they were just like, not a chance. You need to be on bed rest because of you waiting for the liver. But they didn't know that I hadn't gone to see anybody at the liver transplant. I wasn't going to see a transplant team. I haven't been evaluated. I haven't even tried to get on a list. So I ended up going to near South Floridian. I ended up going to Hialeah.
Oh, yeah.
And found a doctor that was just like, you want to go back to work? You don't need time off. And I was like, no, I just needed you to sign this so I can go back.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, no problem. Signed it, walked right back into work, and bam, right back on the line.
Okay.
So for a year and a half, I went back and I was working as a fireman. And we got some really good fire. A whole bunch of medical calls. It was a really amazing experience because for the first time in a long time, my head was in the game. I had a reinstilled love for the fire service, mm-hmm. and I started loving life again, which was so foreign to me. I had been living in days that I thought in my head were always just sad and somewhat dismal. And every once in a while I'd have that like influx of dopamine. I'd be like at the top of the roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like right back down into the pits, but that was my norm. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, it was like, it was always bright out. And then occasionally I'd have like some bad news or something like that.
Okay.
And I was right back to being happy again. And this is the first time in my life that I can remember feeling that way. And it was amazing because work got better. My attitude got better. My relationships got stronger. And I was dying.
But you were at peace with that.
I was 100% at peace with the fact that it was getting better because it got to the point where I kept thinking it was going to end. I kept thinking I was going to relapse. I was just like, this is too good. I don't deserve this. I didn't think that I deserved to be happy.
Okay.
Which is something that I struggle with.
A lot of people struggle with that.
This experience has been nothing but gifts for me.
Right.
Everything that's happened, as tragic as everything was, it's been nothing but amazing. I knew I was dying, and I kept every day pushing myself to just do more. I couldn't take my boots off at work because my feet would swell like to the point of no return. I couldn't, like, if I took my boots off, like my work boots, and I had to put them in bunker gear, I had to do it quick because my feet would blow up to the point where they wouldn't fit in the gear. It was bad. I was yellow as shit. I was jaundiced, out of control. I was usually like, if I had to go into the hospital, I was sicker than most of the people that we were bringing inside. Mm-hmm. And, but again, it was, my mindset was there. My mind was in such a good fucking place. Didn't matter what diagnosis I had. I was still running at 100%. Getting back to our sixth sense of humor, the guys at work did not let anything slide, which made this that much better.
Yeah.
We need that sick, twisted humor, I think, in our profession. It's just, it keeps everything real because when you start trying to fake it or you just start hiding it, everything feels fake. Everything doesn't feel right. It feels like they're avoiding something that's right in their face.
Right.
So these guys threw yellow parties. I remember one time there was we call it a hot dog bar. There was no mustard. And these guys are like, oh, we don't need any mustard. We'll just have Matt run his finger across the hot dog.
Oh, shit.
I know I told the pot that we were ordering pizza and they told me, yeah, we were ordering from Papa Jaundice. Maddie Simpson was one of my favorites. Yeah. Yellow feller. It goes on and on. And these guys didn't let it slide. I as sick as I was, I went to OFC that year and everybody, all my buddies that were instructors were sitting there giving me shit about it. But yeah. It was awesome. It was awesome. And then, you know, like I started getting really lethargic and it was bad. And I remember one of my last shifts, one of my best buds was the boss that day and we were doing a writ. We were doing company drills and we were doing a writ mm-hmm. drill and I thought I was going to die. And, I finished it, but I was just like, I can't be on the truck anymore because I was beforehand when I was, you know, an alcoholic and stuff and, you know, not in the right mindset. I was riding that line between asset and liability.
Yeah.
And now, because my mind was in a perfect place and my body had completely failed me, I was that liability now. There was no way that I was coming in a writ scenario. So that was my last day on shift. Me and my captain flew out to Isaac Frey into the job
mm-hmm.
and we flew into Wichita, went to that. I looked like it was horrible. And on the way home, I was like, bro, I need to go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Went to the doctor, ended up getting blood work and the ultrasound. And I ended up getting a phone call telling me to go directly to the hospital. Went to the hospital, got me in real quick because I was that yellow. Mm-hmm. And you could see it. I was having trouble keeping my unsteady gait. I couldn't stand straight. My hands were, the tremors were getting real bad because the ammonia levels were horrible. Mm-hmm. And by the time I walked into my room, there were about 10 doctors there. And the guy said, listen, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. He's like, you're in the medical field. He's like, we're going to get you comfortable and it's hospice. You need to settle all your finances and that's it.
They were ready to just say it was done. Because it was.
That was it.
What was your first thought? And I'm going to ask that not as, all right, let's rephrase that question. Did you want to drink right then?
No, that was the furthest thing from my mind.
Good. Okay.
After what I had experienced with alcohol and everything I attributed to it, the heartache, the pain, the depression, being intubated, learning how to walk, all that shit, all of that just reminded me of drinking. And that was the furthest and still is the furthest thing from my mind.
Well, in comparison to other people is what I'm trying to go with that question. Some people would take that as an opportunity to just go out on their own terms and say, fuck it, I'm just going to go ahead and drink a bar's worth of alcohol and call it a day, or just self-destruct to the point where they just put themselves out on their own terms in that aspect. But instead, you maintained that level of mindset. You let it impact you for the words that they were, but you obviously weren't ready to give up yet. So you obviously had some more push in you, more fight in you is where I'm going with that statement, that thought process.
And that's, I guess, this is another thing that I need to stress is your head is so strong. Your mind, that mindset is so strong.
Right.
It's insane because when the doctors told me, they were like, you should have died 2 months ago because of my numbers. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're even talking and walking is beyond us. Your numbers do not make sense. Mm-hmm. And it was because I knew that time was running out and I was giving it every ounce, everything I had, everything left in the tank. I was pushing it, man. I mean, and they were mystified by it. They did not understand it. And this is why with the right mind, anything is possible. And that's why it's so important to get into that right mindset. Fuck depression, fuck all that, and get to where your mind is healthy. It's going to make you better in every aspect. I mean, Christ, I was dying and I was still able to live and, you know, function and even work for a small period of time. Mm-hmm. Getting to what I thought about, obviously, you know, like I hate to say this, being from Miami, I was trying to rig something. I was trying to figure out like who I could pay, mm-hmm. you know, like maybe I know somebody and go like find a liver somewhere. I don't know what I'm thinking.
that might be mentality. I get you.
I was bargaining at this point. Yeah. Like in the five stages of death, I've been through this goddamn thing. There's like 20 of them in my life.
Right.
And, you know, I was in the bargaining phase at this time. I'm like, all right, what the fuck? Who can I pay off to get a little bit out of it? Because again, for the first time in my life, I had fallen in love with it. I had fallen in love with being alive. I was taking every conversation I had. Like, it was so hard. Like, everything was amazing. Everything was just beautiful between the conversations, seeing shit, like looking at colors, smelling things, fucking hanging out with animals. Everything was awesome. And I wanted more.
Yeah.
And now they're like, no, you can't have any more. And I'm like a little kid that still wants dessert. I'm going to figure this the fuck out.
Right.
So the first three things I thought about, this is interesting, was those memories. My relationship with time is 100% different. And I just wanted more of it. I wanted more time with my family. I wanted more time with my friends. Those are the first two things I thought about.
Okay.
And all the amazing times I had. The third thing I thought about was gold teeth. Everyone thinks that's so fucked up and funny, but it's true. It's like I was like, I grew up in Miami, you know, it was just like inherently all the tough guys all had girls. Like it was just like the music that I listened to, it was just something I had always wanted. Right. And, so I was like, fuck, I never got gold teeth. Well, Dr. Roach, who was at Cleveland Clinic at the time, and he's now in Lauderdale, and I say this guy's name over and over again because this guy saved my life.
Right.
And he was amazing to my family. It was just, the guy's just a wonderful person. Came in and he was like, listen, don't freak out. He's like, I just need you to make it until tomorrow. And I was like, I'll never forget him saying it. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Make it till tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I did. And the next day the transplant team came in and they wanted absolutely nothing to do with me. And I was just like, listen, I can do this. And my mom's like, you can do it. And they were like, you have to do this test and it's really intense. And you've got to do it days to get on the list. You have to wait. You're not going to make it that long. And I was just like, no, I can do this. So they did these tests over 4 days, and it was the most excruciating, horrible thing that I've ever done in my entire life.
Okay.
Passed out a whole bunch of times. It was just, it was bad, but I passed everything. And they were like, well, you made it. Now we have to vote on it. So they have to, and it was funny. Like I felt like they, it was like a, the meeting of the minds, like they all like wear like cloaks and stuff, and they sit around this fire and they decide who dies and who doesn't.
Like an episode of Survivor.
Huh?
Like an episode of Survivor. Yeah.
And I wasn't really to put my fire out. None of that shit was happening.
Yeah.
And so they go to, and they have to meet with the grand poobah, and they're going to decide whether or not I die or not. And they came back in the room at like 3:34 o'clock, and I hear him walk in, and I was in the John, and, he starts talking. I go, wait. He's like, you can hear me from there. And I go, no, I need to be out there. So I walk out, and they told me that, you know, I had passed everything, and they're decided to take me on. So okay. I made the list.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. That, I mean, that feeling was just like, but now I had to stay alive until that fucking, you know, like until it.
Yeah.
And it's a crazy thing to be happy about, because you realize that like, okay, well, someone's going to pass in order for me to live. And that was a hard thing for, because it came with a lot for me, because this, the whole entire time I was expecting myself to fail with sobriety. And now it's coming to the point where it's like, all right, this is going to happen. You know, are you strong enough to keep continuing to live this way?
Yeah.
I guess it's like kind of like in a righteous sense, like, you know, like I'm about this now, like I'm about being sober, I'm about being mind strong. Like, but now this is it. This is that final decision. Straight up ask you, they're like, are you willing to do? And I looked at my mom and I was like, yes, I can do this.
Okay.
So now it's a waiting game. And they told me, okay, listen, you know, we're gonna get you kind of good. We're gonna discharge you. You know, if you start getting sick, which you're going to, you're gonna have to come back to the hospital. And one of the doctors was like, hey, you know, why don't you stay? And I stayed for a couple of days, and about 11 o'clock at night, I got that phone call. And I didn't understand what she said at first. And she repeated it. She told me, she was like, listen, you know, we have a liver, and we'd like to know if you'd like to accept it. And I didn't know what to say. So the first words out of my mouth were like, well, do you take the first one? Do you shop around? And she was like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know. And, she was like, listen, I can't tell you what to do, but I need you to open your heart and listen to me. She was really sweet.
Yeah.
And she explained it to me again. And I said, yes, of course. And she was like, okay, we'll be in touch. And, she's like, do me a favor and call whoever you need to, because you're not going to be able to talk in about 5 minutes. And I was like, okay. So I called my mom and I got on the phone with my mom. And as soon as she said hello, I was bawling crying.
Yeah.
And, I'll never forget that. Neither can my friends that I called. I was up to like 3 o'clock in the morning calling people. It was intense. It's indescribable. I can't tell you what it meant. It was obviously very humbling. And 16 hours later, after a 13-hour surgery, I was alive, and I'm here to talk about it now.
You woke up when you woke up and you started realizing life around you was continuing. What were some of the thoughts that went through your head when you were able to start making those thoughts happen? Because I know you're just coming out of surgery, you're groggy, but there had to be a sense of self-awareness there for you that, aside from gratefulness and appreciation and for God being there by your side, obviously, and supporting you, because you didn't do this alone. He was there with you. You know that. And we can get religious on this. I'm okay with that. You were determined to live. You had a will. And you were just given the greatest gift that a lot of people wish they could have had. So what were some of the first conscious things that you were thinking of as you were waking up on the other side of this?
To be honest, the first thing I wanted was a hug. And my dad that were inside the room. It was just a relief to see them like kind of like smile and happy, because it was kind of hairy during the surgery.
Yeah.
Period. It wasn't going too good. I was just so overwhelmed by the entire, because this had been going on for so long. And for the first time, it felt like I can like start to like move past this and, you know, go on. For the last year of my life, I had been somewhat purpose driven, and my purpose was living and falling in love with life again for the first time.
Yeah.
And now that I had been afforded this second chance, my purpose had changed. And it wasn't like I wanted to get out of the fire service. It wasn't about anything like that. It was a need to, number one, the person that obviously gave me the gift of life, who I'm never meet, mm-hmm. I needed to do right by them. And that meant sharing this, what we're doing right now. I mean, this is a testament to the team, to my friends, to everything, to the situation that I was in, that it is possible to get out of that like mental fog, to that shitty, depressed, suicidal feeling, and that life is 100% possible and 100% fucking worth it. Just like they're worth it, we're worth it, you're worth it. It's just that I felt purpose driven, that maybe it's not the fire service or me sitting there and getting a grab or doing CPR on somebody where I can make an impact.
Okay.
And I feel like now in that moment, I was like, I'm alive for a reason. And I think that this has a lot to do with it.
But you still love serving. You still love being part of this community. You still thrive.
150%. There's the fire service is so neat. Besides the people, the brotherhood. I mean, the fact is I wouldn't be alive without connections that I made in the fire service. I wouldn't have had that, the overpouring response of love for my family that rode me through this entire torturous 2 years that I put everybody that I've cared about through. The friends, the soulmates, all those people that were involved in this, besides just the fire service, my entire, like, that family, which is inherently... My friends that aren't in the fire department are still like second cousins, I guess, to it.
Right.
Because it's, I did adopt a second family.
Right.
With the traditions and this brotherhood in the fire service. And to people that say that the brotherhood is dead, yeah, I don't know what well they're drinking. It's not.
I think it's selective. And, I think in some cases it can not exist. And I think it depends on the mindset and the culture of the departments that you're around, though, the people you're around.
But what's crazy, I think, about the brotherhood, and I think that people need to take this into consideration, is I could, like, a lot of my closest, I guess, family and brothers on the fire department don't work in my department.
Okay.
And yeah. I think that's what's dynamic. It is that we don't all need to work in the same department. It's a collective of people with that same drive, that same mindset, that, the same belief system, so to speak, of what's important in our job. And that's what's important. Like, again, it can happen in your fire department, and you could work at a small department where no one feels the exact same way, but you've got guys on another department. And that's what, I guess, what's great about the Fools is, like, you've got a whole bunch of guys that are like-minded together, or girls,
right.
And we all vibe and we all love and we all have that same sense of passion and duty to serve. And I think that's what's beautiful about the fire service.
So we're six
it
months
gets a bad rap lately.
Yeah, it does, but we still love it regardless. And it's not perfect.
I got to taste the good of it.
Yeah,
I got the full package of what it means to be a part.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. So 6 months now have passed. Mm-hmm. You're on the other side of recovery. Your life has changed dramatically. You've gone out. You've shared your story a couple of times now, and you talked about how you've been getting questions from a lot of people out there who may be on that threshold, or a carbon copy of you in a sense, maybe, and masking it well. What have been what have been some of the questions you've been asked, and how have you been able to make an impact in ways that maybe we haven't discussed yet, you know, just through your story alone, but just through experiences. And that being said, would you say we still have a long road ahead of us as far as understanding all of this and still making an impact? It's going to take beyond our careers even to possibly do this.
100%. Me and you were touched on this briefly beforehand. The resources are there. It's that bridge. It's the problem. It's the same issue that I had, is not wanting to admit that you have a problem. And then once you do, how do you go about getting to that land of help?
Mm-hmm.
And it's staggered. I've said this before. It's all the help is sitting on this island over here, and you're waiting in water, and they're like, hey, come here. And you're like, no, I'm good. And there's sharks swimming all around you. You're bleeding out. And we need to figure out how to like build that bridge. And the issue is the only, the way that we're doing that right now is not the right way, because we're trying to build that bridge and the only thing we're building it with are dead firemen, mm-hmm. dead first responders. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of room for growth. We've had a lot of good ideas, and this is a very new topic. But again, I was just at the Orlando Fire Conference, and we're in the middle of teaching. We're doing a hot drill, and we're doing engine company ops. And I've got guys with 30, 20 years, another guy from 20 years, and we're having a conversation. We're talking about mental health in the middle of fucking training. That would have never happened 10 years ago. It wouldn't happen 5 years ago.
Yeah, no.
No, not a fucking chance. It's like, hey man, go ahead. Yeah. Grab that coupling and bring it to the door. Yeah. And you know, it's just, you know, the clinicians, it's like that would never, ever happen. The fact that it's open and being talked about is amazing.
Right.
Amazing. And older guys that are starting to talk about this is what I think is going to fix the younger generation.
Okay.
Coming on. The problem that I've seen a lot, and I don't know if I'm jumping around in topics here.
No, it's okay.
Is old, tough, hard charger firemen that start off a conversation with, yeah, you know, like that call kind of bothered me, but I don't want to, it's not PTSD or anything.
Right.
If we need to change the fucking word so that people start, I guess, accepting the fact that like, all right, we've hit every benchmark here, but you don't want to say it like this because you don't want to sound like a pussy,
right?
Or you don't want to seem like you're raping the system. Anything like that, or well, no, it's not that bad. You're comparing yourself to other people's trauma, but it's still not letting you sleep at night. It's still drinking. You're drinking too much. You're treating your wife like shit. You're not really paying attention to your kids because you're so stressed out and you're depressed. Who gives a fuck what it's called? But let's try to get better. And if we need to switch the name, that's more, it's easier to say, or it doesn't have that stigma attached to it, then let's do that. But let's start fucking getting help. Because it's sickening the amount of funerals that we're having to go to.
Yeah.
Those class A's are death rags now. They're not for promotional ceremonies. They're not for anything that I put my clothes on to go to fucking funerals is basically what that turned into. And I'm sick of it.
I get that. And I don't feel like I want to even wear my uniform some days when it comes to it.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of that happen. You know, we had a significant amount of loss in this region in the last several years, and you talk to your peers in the agencies affected, and you talk to men and women who are smart, who are experienced, who are talented at what they do, who care about this profession, and they seem to have answers for problems and solutions, and they are struggling with this concept that these younger and energetic and motivated kids are just taking their own lives, you know, and some of them are middle-aged men, even in our profession, but the younger they get, it's scary to see that. And it's perplexing them. It's like, what more can we do to get the message out there to try to, you know, what level of support do we need? What level of funding, what level of clinician do we need to come in here to try to fix this? And it may be something simple. It may not be. I don't know if I have a thought on that other than it seems like one is too much. And then we see more and more happening. And the younger they get, it's getting closer to the age of my kids. And they want to, you know, a couple of them want to do this profession. It scares me. I don't know if I want my own kids doing this. But when you talk about just getting involved and you look at your peers that we know, that we've seen in this profession engaged, a lot of them are getting frustrated because it seems like we're still fighting an uphill battle. That's what scares me. And yeah, we do have influence, but it seems like we're still fighting a pretty uphill battle.
I mean, 100%. We can't argue the fact that our line of duties are so much lower than suicide
right.
in our profession.
Right.
Me and you spoke earlier about, you know, calling EAP and speaking to clinicians.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned that I think one of the biggest things that could happen is that us having like specialized clinicians that only deal with first responders, because it's such a like niche. And I remember referencing, if I had a problem with my heart, I'm not going to go I'm going to go to a cardiologist as opposed to a general practitioner.
Right. Right.
I think, and this is crazy, and this is topics that I think need to be brought up and talked about, is we need to have specialized training or clinicians that are only dealing with guys on the fire department, or and you had mentioned that probably the military probably does that, but I can't sit and have a conversation about my mental health and the struggles that I'm going through with work with a person who is also talking to Catherine, who is upset with a merger that went wrong. Not that her job is any less stressful or any of her trauma is any less stressful. It's just not in the same, it's not on the same playing field, right. I guess, is where right. I'm trying to get
No, at. You're making sense. I get you. So, but you also brought up an experience with a clinician where, and I think we talked about this before we were recording. I'm fairly certain we did. Mm-hmm. Where you were frustrated and you walked away from that clinician and you encountered a friend who said, hey, what if they had come at you in this direction instead? And that ties into exactly what we were talking about, the need where the collaborative comes in as well, and, yes. And training more clinicians to focus more on the life and the role of the first responder. Alcoholism is alcoholism. Drug addiction is drug addiction. But when you compound it into a specific profession, you cannot relate that of an office worker to that of a firefighter or that of an officer. Mm-hmm. Who's packing a gun on their hip and going to calls over 12 hours where they might not come back from like we could in 24 hours, basically. So you have to find that common ground, and it's not a one size fits all. But when that happened with your peer and the thought and the guidance and the advice given to you, you kind of turned that around when you reintroduced that mindset to that clinician when you went back. Is that correct?
What ended up happening was, I was hurting. I was in the gutter. I could tell him my health was failing me. And I decided, you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to make a phone call. And I went through EAP and, you know, it was very quick. You know, they dealt with my insurance. And when I got on the phone with the first therapist or clinician, you know, I went through it and I was just like, hey, listen, you know, like I've had a lot of deaths, especially suicide lately. You know, I'm not doing too well. I'm drinking too much. I think I'm like clinically depressed. Like I'm thinking about killing myself. Like I just had a bad call where someone killed themselves in the exact same way that my friend did. And it's kind of fucking with me. Yeah, this is what I'm at. All right. Help me. You know, like I've fucking hid this forever. I've finally gotten the balls to sit there and say, I have a fucking problem. What do you got for me? Mm-hmm. And the response was, well, I know exactly what you're going through. And I was like, get the fuck out of here. Are you kidding me? You know what I'm going through? You've had this exact same instance, or you work for a fire department? And I was completely turned off. And I just went about doing my own thing. I was like, well, if that's help, it's not for me. And there's nothing that's going to fucking help me at this point. And it had been an excuse. It probably was, but it was an excuse for me to not do anything after that. And it completely shut me off to the clinician field. What ended up happening was, we were in Orlando and I saw all the clinicians out there and they were the initiative, and you know, like, they have a program where they're taking these clinicians that want to deal with the first responders and put them through various exercises. And they came to the class that I was with, and we were upstairs, and they were doing dummy drags, or they were dragging down firefighters or victims. And I was pissed. I was upset. You know, they were all standing there, and it was just irritating to me because I was just like, this is the exact same thing that's going to happen. They're going to come, they're going to see this, and they're going to sit there and they're going to give the exact same excuse. Oh, I know what you're going through because I did this. And I ended up walking downstairs, and one of my best friends is the chief of our department, Danny Moran. And he was over with another class. And I just went over there and I was venting because, you know, this is like near and dear to my heart. And like this, that, you know, I want to work. This is like my purpose. And I was just like, this is the wrong fucking way, these people. And I was just bitching. And he sat down and he had a conversation with me. And he said, well, you know, what if they did this? You know, like they're doing this training and they approached you this way. And what he said was, you know, you come to them and you start explaining a problem, especially let's say you weren't able to bring someone out and they ended up burning up, or you had a struggle and they ended up passing when you got outside. And the clinician looked at you or said to you, oh my God, you know, like I went to this training in Orlando and I had to, you know, deal with a dummy and it was nowhere near. I can't even imagine with the heat. I can't even imagine. And me even doing that, I was struggling. I can't imagine you doing that. And I was like, wow, you know, like I could talk to this person. It was very relatable to me.
Yeah.
Because you weren't saying that you've done this before, or you weren't like, oh yeah, I've done this and I've gotten over it. You brought yourself down to my level and now we can have a conversation because we have something in common. Mm-hmm. Oh, you did the training. Now I'm going to be a lot more apt to talk to you. So Danny's like, so you need to be the change with them. If that's something that you think is going to help or deter you, why not tell them? Well, a little while after that, Steve Negley came up to me and was like, hey, Matt, I want you to go talk to the clinicians. And I was like, well, you know, maybe I'm going to take Danny's advice. And I went in there and I sat there and I told my story and I explained to them what happened with me. And it was completely well received. It was awesome. They had a really good time. Steve got to talk about his experience, and I think it was a home run all the way around. And again, that's why I can't stress enough having people that are completely dedicated to our scene, which I think is going to be a huge help to people after they break through that barrier of, okay, I'm going to admit that maybe I need to talk to somebody, and then having someone that's knowledgeable enough and the way to talk to us, I think that's going to be an amazing thing.
Outstanding. I couldn't agree with you more. All right, well, let's talk about where Matty Johnson's heading next. What are we doing? What direction are we heading? What's our plan?
Huh?
What's our plan?
Again, I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm talking with Corley at the end of April, and then I'm going up to FDIC just to go do it. I've really, really clung to this fourth quarter lifestyle. That last year I had, even though I was dying and my body was shit, was the most amazing thing that I've experienced in my life.
Yeah.
I loved harder. I worked harder. You know, like my experiences were better. Everything was, it was good. It was hard. It was tough. I dealt with a lot of loss. I had to learn how to have fun again, but I'm at a right place now where I want to keep this momentum going. As far as mental health and, you know, helping out in any way I can. I think there's a lot of avenues that need to be talked about. I don't know if that's going to happen in me doing more podcasts, doing like a mental health kind of podcast, but I definitely want to keep talking about this. You had said, it's funny, like I've worked my ass off in the fire service, and now I'm going to be pegged as the mental health guy, which is crazy. It's better than being an ambulance guy or an EMS guy.
Yeah. No, I get that.
But again, I've been there. I feel like my time in hell and in the trenches is going to be very beneficial. And I'm going to bring up an instance today. So after the podcast, you know, I like it. We had talked about, like, I got a whole bunch of phone calls.
Yeah.
Recently, I got a phone call, and one of my buddies was like, hey, I've got a friend of mine whose brother is in a very similar situation as you. And he's actually at Cleveland Clinic, and he's going through the exact same thing that you are. You know, would you mind talking to his brother? And I was just like, oh, this is my hospital, the same doctors I was dealing with. This is my wheelhouse. And yesterday, after speaking on the phone and, you know, doing all that stuff yesterday, I was able to, go to the hospital. I met the brother. I met, the person who's going through the struggle in the exact same fucking condition that I was, and, meet his family. And it was actually really, really hard, for me to see his family, because it, now being an outsider, I could see the stress and like this just pain that everyone is in inside this room, you know, having to watch this, and how it's like a brother, a son, and the emotion and just like the energy that was in the room was crazy. And it just made me think about how much, you know, I put my family and my friends through. But it's actually amazing, because like I feel like it's not so much that I'm getting through, but it's like I'm supposed to be there. I'm supposed to be in that room. I feel like I'm helping out tremendously with something that I would have never thought for myself beforehand. And usually I don't think I would, after everything I went through with my mental health, I would put myself in a position to start getting sad and stuff. But I feel like I'm so on top of where I need to be in the head game, to where I have people that I can reach out to. I have a therapist that I can talk to, that I can log the load to, that it's nothing but beneficial for me to put myself in that position right now. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing, because I know there's a way to get out of this. There's a way to get over this, because I was there. And I remember when that light switch switched for me, and it's so easy. And I feel like that I'm relatable enough to the subject that I can get through to a lot of people. And that's what I want to do.
You still have bad days though, right?
100%. But those bad days, those, like we were talking about, those, I lived in such a bad day all the time when I was sad.
Yeah.
With glasses on. The sunglasses were like my fucking norm. I was always living in the dark, and I had those brief synapses of, you know, being elated or having like that dopamine release where everything was happy when I was with my friends, when I was drinking, and then it was right back down in the gutter. That was my comfort. That was my home. That's where I lived, was in that dark, shitty, miserable, depressed place. And those little glimpses of sunlight were great, but they were few and far between. Now everything is switched. Now I live in this wonderful daylight of just being happy. And those little times, and those times that the negative shit comes around or where I start feeling sad, I've got tools where I know I'm starting to feel sad. I'm going to reach out and talk to somebody. I'm going to get up and do something. I'm going to eat. I'm going to go do something to get out of this funk, because this is not normal. That sad space is not normal for me anymore.
Right. Right.
And it's a mindset. And once you get that, and it's so simple, it's, I don't want to say it's smooth sailing, but it's 100% better than being in that shit dark place, in that dungeon.
No, but it's easy to allow that to cripple you, that negativity.
Oh yeah, because it's comforting. You don't know it, but that depressive state to you, like, you don't know it at the time, but sitting in your room by yourself with a bottle of Jameson or a bottle of Tito's and watching fucking Netflix by yourself, not talking to anybody, avoiding plans, calling out of work, that seems like fun to you. Like, oh, I called out of work. Great. And I'm going to sit here and do absolutely nothing for the entire day besides drink and be fucking miserable.
Yep.
But again, no, that's happy for me. That's that. Oh, this is great. No, that's not great.
So
not. I'm all for sitting down and relaxing.
Oh yeah.
And having a good time and watching Netflix. Of course.
Who doesn't?
Of course. The Last of Us, Christ sakes. I mean, I love that show right now.
I can't get into it. I'm trying.
It's good. It's good.
I think my daughter used the word conically or chronically or whatever it was. She goes, it is conically like the game. So what you're seeing is what you're seeing in the introduction to the game, basically. You know, the first episode. She's like, it's almost perfect. I'm like, is it just because it's Pablo Pascal? I mean, because you like the Mandalorian and, you know.
Everybody
like,
does.
Yeah, who doesn't love that guy, right? But
everybody
she's
does.
She's like, no, it's really a good series, Dad. I'm like, okay, fine. So I watched episode one. I got into like half episode two. I'm trying. I'm struggling. I'm usually a late bloomer when it comes to series.
All right, how about Peaky Blinders?
Okay, you're going to hate this, but straight up Peaky Blinders.
Oh, okay.
Two episodes.
You're
going to
lose
episodes.
Viewers for this shit. Go ahead.
No, I got to watch it. I've only had two episodes. I watched the episode, the intro episode. I'm trying to remember when they were standing at the docks. No, not the docks, by the factory, and he executed his buddy. That was like the episode. Right, because it was expected for him to do that. All right. But that was like the one or two episodes. No, I've gotten into Tulsa King recently.
Okay.
And then Mayor of Kingstown, I found to be a pretty fascinating fucking series. Jeremy Renner's really outdone himself on that one. I mean, I was the guy that got into Breaking Bad late. Okay. I'm talking like season five and a half, right? Right at the half point of season five is when I started binging it. But no, I don't know. It goes up and down, you know, the ebbs in the flow or the tide when it comes to TV. But no, Kingstown, Tulsa King. What was the other one I got into recently? I think we're going to start watching History of the World Part 2, because, I mean, how can you not like Mel Brooks? Seriously.
Brooks? Of course.
God help me. You know.
But definitely get into Peaky Blinders.
All right, I'll get into Peaky Blinders.
But to get back to what I was saying,
back
I 100%, there's a difference between enjoying some time alone and isolating.
Yeah.
And, again, and you do that shit at work. It's like, exact same thing. When I was sad, my entire realm changed as far as we're concerned. I get there, I check off a truck, I fucking barely help out with station duties. I was a shit bag at the station. And I'd go in my room and I'd fucking maybe come out for food, maybe come out for chow, maybe not.
Okay.
And I'd just be in my room and I'm like, ooh, I get to fucking take a nap today for 10 seconds before I have to go run another call.
Yeah.
But it was like, normal, and that's not good. That is not fun. Fucking going outside the station and training, talking shit, having the kitchen table discussions, pranking another station. That's the fun stuff.
Fucking right.
And that's
it
what
is.
I was started. And that's what I started doing that last year. I started having fun again.
Hell yeah. You started
like a little kid.
Well, you're renewing your love for the job and yourself. Well, you can't love your the job if you don't love yourself, number one. And I say that because you may have been happy with the job. You may have loved what you've done, but if you can't love yourself, how can you love anything else? And it sounds like everything you've experienced based on what you're telling me and what you've told others, and it is very compelling that now that you have found a true respect or love for yourself, you're able to accept the fact that you're human. We're all human. We're all flawed. We have various levels of coping. Some of us are missing certain components, but if you're just willing to listen to your fucking peers and those people around you that can send you in a direction to help you, I mean, you can have that guidance. It does come down to you accepting it and making the difference on your own, or being forced to in your situation. Change can happen. Change can happen.
100%. It is. It's awesome. And being where I'm at now, I wake up every day excited as opposed to before. It's night and day, night and day. And I really want everybody to be like this. One thing I want to say is to the guys that, especially the big time firemen, who the job is like super important, right, and job is everything. It's not our time, it's their time. Like those kind of guys, they're worth the risk. If you are not 100%, or let's just say 95%, because everyone's got their issues, mentally right, you are a shit fireman. You're going to make poor decisions. You're going to be shit to your crew. It doesn't work. You cannot be completely invested at work and not completely invested with being right. That's a huge thing.
No, that makes sense.
You're going to make bad decisions. Your head is where it's at. Just like keeping your body in physical strength to be able to do the job, you need to be mentally strong as well. And you become a full servant at that point.
You have to find balance though. And something I've caught myself saying, you know, recently in just conversation, cause it kind of clicked, you know, it truly comes down to your relationship with God, your family, then your job. All right. Mm-hmm. Your job shouldn't be your first priority. Okay. Your job, even though it is your paycheck, even though it's your livelihood, I hate to say this, but your job isn't what you're married to. You're married to the woman, okay, that took your hand and gave you a family and gave you the support, the love and everything. And if you can't find the balance to give them the time they deserve, the love they deserve, then what is the career worth in the end? What does it matter how good of a fireman you are, or how great you do at certain things? It doesn't fucking matter, because that career is going to be gone in 25 to 30 years. But the marriage is not, the children are not, and they're there forever, and they have a right to earn the rewards on that investment that you created, okay? And that is time, that is dedication, that is being a good parent in the end, and you can't let the job take that away from you.
No. The again, getting back to my relationship with time and how important time is and what takes time away from you, it's, you know, being in the teaching circuit, and I don't have children, but being in the teaching circuit and working a job on the fire department and doing these things, one thing that we're so easy, and I can't take credit for this. This is Danny Moran's thing, but it's, I love it. We're so quick to sit there when people are like, man, you guys are so close, that family on the fire department. The first words out of pretty much 90% firemen's mouths are, well, we spend a third of our life together.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that people don't take into account, it's great, but those 30 plus years that you're working on the fire department, your wife and your family spends a third of the time without you.
Yeah, that's true.
So when we're and then you add on training and going to training events and, or going and teaching and doing these things, and that wife or that husband is back at home taking care of your children, cooking, trying to work their job. It's a crazy dynamic. And that's, again, when you start thinking about time and taking time out of your day, if your family is not number one or number two in your case, 'cause you were talking about God and faith, everything at work is not going to be right. If your home life is not the most important thing and everyone in your family is accounted for, your kids are good with you, your relationship with your wife is strong, then that's going to weigh on you at work. And it's not going to be good. That, I mean, family is so important. And like I said, that was the thought about when I was dying. I didn't give a fuck about running calls. It wasn't any of that. Obviously, yes, the times, the fires I had because of the memories that I had with my friends and sitting around the kitchen table were very, very important. But those time, those sitting down and just watching TV with your family, or, you know, like going to your daughter's quince, or excuse me, 16s.
Oh, I know what a quince is. Yeah. You don't have yet. Hopefully most people know what a quince yet is. If they ever grew up, you know, anywhere. Yeah. They should know what a quince is. Come on.
And, it's just, but those, your family time, you know, like, not working that overtime shift to be home with your family, maybe missing, like a training. It's, when your number's called, man, all you want is more time. Just make sure you spend it right. And, yeah.
That's beautiful, man. Maddie Johnson, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
That was a great hour, almost hour and a half right there. A lot.
Hell yeah.
You opened up, and I do love every bit of your story, the good and the bad, because it is impactful. And anybody who listens to it needs to pay attention, because they're going to see it, or they might be experiencing it. And this is where you need to come to terms. It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to let your guard down. And it's okay to depend on other people to help you, including your family, because they'll be there for you. You just have to relent.
100. Yeah. It's the hardest and the easiest thing to do in the world.
Amen. Thanks for coming on today, brother. No. I really appreciate it. And that being said,
it's awesome,
guys,
being on. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been a great episode back. It's been a little bit of a break. What a way to start off the new season with Maddie Johnson. And as always, keep your head on a swivel. Look out for your brother and sister. And we'll see you on the next one.